Accession number 19672, Reel 1.
Mr. Neil Siddle, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Rush Home in Manchester in 1922.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Manchester?
My father was an itinerant motor mechanic in those days, and he travelled the country for the various companies he worked for. I started school, I think, in Manchester, but we moved to Oswestry, to Dublin, and finally to Liverpool.
So, which place do you consider to be your hometown?
My place of birth, Manchester.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
I was 14 and a half.
So that would have been in 36 or 37?
Yeah.
Did you get a job?
I went to sea in the Merchant Navy for the Cunard White Star Line for about 18 months, just prior to the war breaking out.
Can you tell me something about your experiences in the Merchant Navy pre-war, please?
Well, I was engaged as a bellboy in the first instance. My pay, as it was called in those days, was £2 per week. Of course, food was provided, but we had to provide our own uniforms. We were on call for 24 hours a day if necessary, even at that tender age. And I well remember working 12, 14 hours a day on the various ships that I served on.
Can you name the ships, please?
I served on RMS Scythia, RMS Lancastria, which was bombed off the beaches of Dunkirk in 1940, RMS Antonia, and RMS Athenia.
Did you get very tired doing the job?
Did I?
Get very tired doing the job?
I don't ever remember being tired. It was all a great adventure. Exciting.
You liked the job?
I liked it very much, yes. I always wanted to go to sea.
What did you particularly like about it?
Probably the freedom, the fresh air, the loneliness sometimes. Sounds strange, I know, for a boy of those age, of that age, but that's how I felt. I loved going to sea.
Why
I loved the company.
Why should you be lonely?
No, I didn't mean that in the sense that I didn't want other people around. When you're at sea, there is a great feeling of being alone with nature, if for want of a better term, and I enjoyed that.
What was the company like to work for in those days?
Fair and firm. We were well treated, poorly paid on reflection, but treated well, generally speaking.
How did the firmness show itself?
Pardon?
How did the firmness show itself?
Well, if you stepped out of line, you were fined part of your wage or salary, perhaps confined to shore, not given another ship for a period of time, and things like that.
Was that a deterrent to have those type of punishments?
Well, I would imagine so, yes. Yeah. It never happened to me. I was never grounded, for want of a better term.
Apart from the pay, was there anything you did not like about the job?
No, I can't recall anything that I did not like.
Which parts of the world did you see?
Well, I was confined mostly to the North Atlantic. We went to New York via Boston during the fine weather. In the winter weather, we went to Halifax, Nova Scotia. And sometimes in the early summer, we did cruises through the Scandinavian countries, Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Iceland, Finland, all around the North Cape.
How were you treated by passengers?
Exceedingly well. Particularly Americans. They couldn't believe that people so young were working at sea for such long hours. They just couldn't believe it. So they were very, very generous.
What size of tip would they often give?
Well, in those days, it was not unusual to receive a £5 tip. And £5 was 2 months' pay, or 2.5 months' pay, for that matter. So at the end of each trip, probably we would end up, each of us, with £20 or £30 in tips, which was a lot of money in those days, a lot of money. And of course, it all went to Mum and Dad, or not all of it, but most of it went to Mum and Dad to help them through their struggle, I suppose you could call it, although my father was always employed. I can't ever remember him being out of work. So I would say that we had a fairly good childhood with regard to food and clothing and warmth and love and all the other things that make a family.
And would the non-American passengers give you big tips too?
Well, it was the theme in those days. People that travelled on boats apparently had plenty of money and were not shy with it, for want of a better phrase. They were generous in their tips for the services that were performed by whoever.
What was your accommodation like aboard?
Very cramped, very smelly, very noisy. Usually over the aft part of the ship, above the engine room. So you've got the continual thump of the propellers. And of course, when the sea was rough, you got the woof of the rise and fall of the ship. It was hot. There was no air conditioning in those days. Not down there, anyway. So it was hot and smelly. Not very pleasant.
Where did smell come from?
Well, I suppose it's the smell of a ship. It's diesel and bodies, confined spaces, all sorts of human smells.
Did you think a war was coming?
Well, we talked about it from 1938 onwards. It was fairly apparent that something was going to happen, whether it was going to be war or not. At that age, we weren't really bothered anyway. It was more of an adventure than the fearsome thing it turned out to be eventually. But to us young lads, it was an adventure, probably.
What happened to you on the day war was declared?
Well, I'd come ashore. I'd finished with the Merchant Navy. I'd had enough, for the time being, anyway. And on the day war broke out, I was working for Littlewoods, the football pool people, cleaning cars in their garage in Liverpool. And I volunteered the next day and was told to come back in January of 1940 because I was too young. So I would have been 17 and a quarter in January of 1940, and I was old enough then to join the Marines.
Why did you immediately volunteer?
Well, it was a feeling amongst young men at that time that something was going to happen and the Germans were at it again and we weren't going to let them do that, and pride, I suppose, and patriotism and the unknown, sense of adventure again, I suppose.
Yeah, and did you volunteer for the Marines?
Yes.
Why the Marines?
Well, that took my fancy. They were a seagoing unit. I liked the uniform. I thought I would look good in it. And I volunteered for the Marines. And I never got to sea with them. I was always based on shore.
Why not the Navy?
I couldn't get in the Navy. I was too young for a seaman and too old for a boy. And the only way I could get into the Marines, incidentally, was by signing for 12 years, because conscription had not then started. So I volunteered for the Marines and I signed for 12 years.
Anything happened to you up to January 1914?
No, not really. I didn't tell my parents what I'd done. And in January, a letter came for me from the recruiting officer telling me to come down to be sworn in, which I did, and receive the King's shilling. So, and instructions would follow for me to report to wherever they sent me to. And about a fortnight later, I got another letter telling me to report to the recruiting office in Liverpool, en route for Deal, the training depot for Marines in Kent.
Why had you not told your parents?
Well, I thought they would try and stop me from joining because of my age, which they eventually tried to do. When I told them, and I told my mother, my father had gone to work at the time, and I told my mother that I was going to Deal to join the Marines. And of course, she was upset. And I suppose she got in touch with my father, and I hadn't been in the Marines a fortnight when I was pulled in front of my commanding officer then at the depot, who told me that my father had tried to have me released from the Marines because of my age. But because I'd volunteered and I was over 17 and a quarter by then, and the war was on, of course, it was refused.
What did your mother say to you when she found out?
Please don't go. Wait until your father comes home and talk it over with him.
Any memories from Deal?
Oh, many. many. I was detailed by the recruiting officer to take charge of three Irish chaps who'd come over from Ireland to join the Marines. And their accent was so thick that nobody apart from me could understand them. I could understand them because I had a good ear for dialects. So I was in charge of them. And we left Liverpool at 10 o'clock in the morning from Lime Street Station. And because of the way transport was in those days, it was midnight before we got to Deal in Kent. And we were met by a sergeant in a 1500 weight truck who took us into the barracks, took us to the stables, gave us a palliasse and a pillowcase, and said, fill those with straw, which we did. And the straw was chaff, as opposed to straw. He took us into a barrack room where there were three pull-out steel frame beds. That was our beds. Put your palliasses on there. There's a blanket, there's a blanket, there's a blanket. Good night, Revalli's at 6 o'clock. Psh, and off went the light. The next morning when we woke up to the sound of the Revalli, one of the Irishmen had gone. He disappeared in the night, and we never saw him again. The other two were with me right the way through, right through training for the next 12 months or so. That was one of the incidents.
And then?
Well, another funny incident was the issue of the webbing equipment that we had to wear, which we drew from the quartermaster store, and were shown how to assemble it, and then how to clean, blanco it with this paste, and how to polish the buttons without getting any residue on the webbing. And we were to parade on the following Monday morning at 8 o'clock, fully dressed in our clean, shining equipment. Well, I thought I'd be very clever and leave mine until the Sunday and do it all then. And of course, it didn't dry. And I couldn't put it together properly. And when all the others left the barrack room at 7:30 on the Monday morning to parade at 8 o'clock, I am still struggling to fit mine together. And if it hadn't been for a trained soldier, as we called them in those days, a man that had been in the service for a while, who came into my barrack room and saw me, and I was almost in tears. I just could not fathom out how to put it together. Eventually, with his help, I got it together, but it looked an awful mess. Everything was smudged and the brasses were covered in fingerprints and everything. And eventually got on parade at 10 o'clock, just as the squad was going for their mid-morning nappy break. So I got a rocket off the sergeant, obviously. Eventually, 7 days confined to barracks. Not that we were allowed out anyway, but I was given 7 days confined to barracks. That was my first taste of how to assemble webbing equipment. I mastered it, eventually.
What did you think of the training at Deal?
I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. I felt it was great. And I look at today's troops being trained by this shouting, bawling, screaming at them, which I suppose has something to do with their psychological makeup. I pity them, because we didn't have that sort of treatment. Ours was shouted, but not into your face, and you weren't ridiculed and bullied, for want of a better phrase. It was a different sort of training altogether. No, I really enjoyed it, and I was good at it.
Did that approach by the NCOs produce the desired effect?
Sorry?
Did that approach by the NCOs produce the desired effect?
Oh, Lord, yes. We were highly trained. I'm proud.
Any other memories of Deal before we leave it?
No, I don't think so. No.
What happened next?
Well, we then went to our division, which was Portsmouth, for naval gunnery training. And whilst in Portsmouth, which would be around about June or July, I suppose, of 1940, a notice went up on the notice board for volunteers for hazardous duty. And it turned out, eventually, that it was a party required to go over to Holland and bring out the royal family from Holland, from The Hague. And most of my squad volunteered for it, myself included. But we were turned down because we were still in training and not considered capable, really, of carrying out that duty. Anyway, we did our naval gunnery, which was very interesting. Whilst we were at the naval gunnery school one day, there was an air raid. And a Junkers 88 dropped a stick of bombs right along the seafront at Eastney, which is where we were training, and hit the gunnery school. And the rest of our forenoon that day was spent in pulling out the guys that didn't make it, which was rather sickening and saddening. The first time I'd been in contact with dead people. My memory of it is that when we were pulling them out, it was just like pulling out a uniform with nothing in it, because it had all been blasted. There was nothing, it had all been blasted away. I wouldn't say it was traumatic, but it was a sobering thought for, possibly of things to come.
That was May 40, was it?
Pardon?
That was May 1940.
No, that was in July, I think. July, I think. Might have been August. It was whilst we were doing our naval gunnery, anyway. And then we finished our training off completely with field training and range work, you know, rifle and machine gun. And by November, we were no longer called recruits, we were Marines.
And then?
And then I was drafted overseas. As far as I knew, I was going to the Middle East. And we left Portsmouth in December of 1940. And eventually arrived by convoy via the Suez Canal. Finally arrived at Alexandria in February, I think, of 1941. No, January it was. January 41. And from Alexandria, I got posted to Malta. And I spent 2.5 years in Malta during the Blitz.
Where were you stationed in Malta?
A shore establishment, HMS St. Angela.
And which unit were you with there?
Pardon?
Which unit were you with there?
Well, I was the Royal Marine Detachment aboard HMS St. Angela. It was a shore establishment, but it worked as a ship. You know, we had mess decks and everything was the same as though you were aboard a ship, only you were on a shore base.
What were conditions like in Malta during those years?
Grim. They got worse as the years went on. You know, 1941 was the start of the air raids. 1942 was a really bad year for everything. Air raids, shipping losses, civilian casualties, shortage of food, shortage of everything for that matter. And yet, we had some good times. You know, we always remember the good times.
What kind of good times could you have?
Well, occasionally, when there were no air raids, you were allowed ashore, which meant going across the harbour to Valletta, for argument's sake, going to a cabaret, having a few glasses of local wine, beer, if the convoy had got through and brought some oil so they could produce it. Things like that.
What did cabarets consist of?
Pardon?
What did cabarets consist of?
Usually, a couple of homosexuals who were trapped on the island with their very beautiful sister, Frankie, Bobby and Sugar, they were known as. And they did a very good act between them. She sang, they clowned about, as homosexuals do, but it was good fun, you know, and that's all it was. Occasionally a cinema, you know, a cinema show, occasionally with old films, but after 12 months you'd seen them all, and there weren't many replacements. But you made your own fun, and we had our issue of rum daily, which we saved up, and when you felt inclined that way, you had a bender.
Were these homosexuals English?
Oh, I've no idea. I don't think so. No.
Where did they originate from then?
I don't know. They were trapped there when the war broke out. They just either trapped there or decided to stay there. I'm not sure which. But I'm not sure of their nationality. One of them looked Italian. Well, the two chaps looked Italian. The girl looked very English, actually. She was a very, very attractive girl. Blonde. Not having anything to do with them personally, I couldn't really tell you. But they were great fun. Everybody spoke of them. You know, not disparagingly. They were part of the scene. Probably no doubt blokes who've been in Malta will tell you the same thing. Yeah. But the infamous gut, which is known as Strada Stretta in Malta, Straight Street, was absolutely full of little pubs. And they all sold wine, local wine, and beet. And as I say, when the brewery was brewing, they sold beer. And they in turn perhaps had a girl or somebody that would sing or dance. You know, that's the form of entertainment we had. Oh, and there was Tom Bowler. Occasionally they played Tom Bowler, which is another way of passing a couple of hours.
Did anybody persecute these homosexuals?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge, no.
How did you get on with the Maltese themselves?
Very well. Very well indeed. We were all in it together. I mean, they suffered just the same as we did. Probably more, because we had more, probably had more food than they did.
Did any of them show any resentment that the English might have brought this on them?
Well, there were murmurings at one time when the raids were at their height, and I've no doubt some of the political-minded people would have preferred perhaps to have been on the other side and not have to be bombed. But generally speaking, I would say the Maltese were very, very pro-British. They depended upon the dockyard for a start, for a living for most of the men. They depended upon the trade that was brought to them by soldiers, sailors, airmen, marines, what have you. You know, so they were dependent. And I don't think there was a great deal of animosity, personally.
Any recollections you can put on tape of the actual bombing? Or strafing, for that matter?
Well, it's one long, continuous bombing, as far as we were concerned. I don't think... Very, very seldom did the day pass by when the air raid didn't sound. One incident that sticks out is one of our detachment who had been put ashore in hospital for an operation off one of HM ships was detached to us whilst his ship left and went out on convoy duty somewhere. And that ship was either torpedoed or blown up in a minefield with a loss of all hands. And I can't remember which ship it was, but this guy was so upset at the loss of all his shipmates that he committed suicide in our gun emplacement office, for want of a better phrase, where we used to answer the phone to tell us of air raids and things like that. We got information to be passed on to our two Beaufort guns.